are we reaching essentially a moment of history where we can't sort of find the technological vessels that allow us to leap into another era of human development? And are those physical boundaries, those biophysical boundaries that we're hitting, are they going to question the way in which we deal with each other and with the sense of humanity that we want to, that we've tried over time to cultivate, including via certain sort of complex political systems?
Hello and welcome to Planet Critical, the podcast for a world in crisis. My name is Rachel Donald. I'm a climate corruption journalist and your host. Every week, I interview experts who are battling to save our planet. My guests are scientists, politicians, academics, journalists, and activists. They explain the complexities of the energy, economic, political, and cultural crises we face today, revealing what's really going on and what they think needs to be done. These are the stories of the big picture. Go to planetcritical.com to learn more and subscribe. My guest this week is Olivia Lazard. Olivia is a research fellow at Carnegie Europe. Her research focuses on the geopolitics of climate, the transition ushered by climate change, and the risks of conflict and fragility associated to climate change and environmental collapse. She's also an environmental peacemaking and meditation practitioner with over 12 years of experience in the peacemaking sector at field and policy levels. I have been dying to speak with Olivia for months, and I was so thrilled when she agreed to an interview. This is just an awesome conversation. And it's the kind of conversation that I really think helps elucidate what is going on. We go from micro details with regards to mining and environmental impact to big picture thinking, systems change, even a spot of metaphysics. And essentially what we tease out is this human relationship to materiality and demateriality, and how a perverse relationship to both facilitates really violent systems. Olivia talks about the five steps in the Anthropocene and how violence increases with each step. And that's particularly worrying given the last one was nuclear. And this step that we're in is digitalization plus an energy transition. She speaks a lot about artificial intelligence, how it's being embedded into existing problematic systems and the security risks it creates, especially in a resource-scarce world where we're seeing increasing resource wars and the drive towards an energy transition that is both energy blind and materials blind. We live in legacy systems of extraction and violence and appear to be doubling down on those systems, she says, seeking to use more and more energy in the name of progress, development, and even leaving the material world behind. We talk about the history of linear thinking and the role of science both in solving problems and perpetuating some. We talk about geoengineering, how it is being used to combat the effects of climate change rather than the drivers of climate change. We talk about the age of terror versus rationality, the role of religion in a dematerialized society. We talk about transhumanism, embodied politics, senses and sense-making, and above all, how humanity and reality is relational, that our intelligence depends on relationality, and that competition, which, as Olivia says, is at the heart of the balance of power, has not only created systems of rivalry, but rivalries of systems, which is tipping a planet that's already in crisis into even more danger. I hope you all enjoy the episode. If you do, please share it far and wide. And if you're loving the show, support Planet Critical with a paid subscription at planetcritical.com. By signing up, you'll get the Planet Critical newsletter inspired by each episode delivered straight to your inbox every week. You'll also have access to the wonderful Planet Critical community, who are full of inspiring thoughts, ideas, critiques, and determination. I'm so grateful to everyone who chooses to support the project. I'm a vehement believer in ad-free and open access content, so Planet Critical wouldn't exist without the direct support of the amazing community. Thank you so much to all of you who believe in Planet Critical and keep the project going every week. Olivia, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Rachel.
My very first question for you, just a small one, is why is the world in crisis?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we all have our bit of answer to this, right? But I suppose I'll give an answer this morning, which comes on the back of research that I've been doing about the history of the Anthropocene. I was reading a book recently. I'll find the name again for you because I'm terrible at remembering names. I just remember the content of books. by Simon L. Lewis and another author, Maslach, I think. They talk about the reality of the Anthropocene and the history of the Anthropocene. And what was interesting about their book, you may have heard essentially that there is a massive debate at the moment as to when the Anthropocene started, if it ever started in the first place as a geological era. And the Anthropocene Working Group recently sort of came to a conclusion that the official date for the start of the Anthropocene is somewhere around the 1960s, when we could observe essentially the fallout of nuclear sediments in a number of different areas around the world in the biosphere, right? Like the impact of human technological sort of findings or innovations was obviously sort of observed in a very sort of significant sort of way across the biosphere. But what was interesting about the way that they sort of talked about the history of the Anthropocene is that they divided it in four ways. The first debate was whether or not the agricultural revolution, which comes very early on at the start of the Holocene essentially, was an initial step into the history of the Anthropocene, right? Because it's the moment when humans congregated or sort of, you know, settled essentially in permanent settlements, and then, you know, societies sort of developed hierarchies, division of labor, domesticated animals, et cetera, et cetera. And then they talk about a second step, which is the era of colonial expansion and colonial discoveries, which led to what we call the Orbis spike in the 1610, I think, where again, we can see essentially sort of traces within the biosphere, data telling us, well, you know, humans were there. Humans did something to the environment. Then the third sort of, step in the history of the Anthropocene that they talk about is the one that we most often hear about, which is the Industrial Revolution, the extraction of fossils, and the acceleration of initial anthropogenic sort of impacts of the colonial era in a much more accelerated way, which allowed essentially to expand even more in spatial terms, and which allowed to sort of do deeper types of extractions and develop more chemical-oriented types of innovations from a technological perspective and a technical perspective. And then the last bit is indeed the nuclear aspect, right? And if you put those four things together, I have no competence, I'm not a natural scientist, so I have no competency to decide as to whether or not, you know, the agricultural revolution or the sort of industrial revolution was the start of the Anthropocene. That's not what I find of interest. What I find of interest is the story that it creates, essentially, in terms of how humans have evolved within the biosphere. Starting with this notion of settlement, which led to social and political hierarchies, which produced their own sets of violence, right? And then the sort of notion of, well, the colonial era was essentially led to an age of discoveries, starting from Europe, which it's expanded into the Americas, the African continent, Asia, a number of different places. And it was underpinned essentially by political and geopolitical competition between different European empires, and which led essentially to this sort of escalation of tension. And we need more means to sustain that competition. And then we go and sort of fetch those means somewhere else. And that creates a whole narrative about progress. And that creates a whole narrative about sort of technological innovation and discoveries being at the helm of progress for humans in general, which, you know, one set of humans decided to impose a notion of progress on a vast amount of the people who did not really have a say in that. And then obviously the sort of, you know, fossil extraction is the concentration of energy, this extraordinary discovery in the form of coal and gas and oil, which allows to do so much more in such little time, and to accelerate, you know, spatial expansion and to do much, much more in terms of like understanding how molecules functions and things like this. And then on the back of this, having a technological innovation, which takes violence to a whole new level. And
which sort of also couples violence to a certain extent with this narrative of innovation and progress. And it's very hard to disentangle everything because at the end of the day, we've had some really extraordinary discoveries in the last 200 years from a scientific perspective, which have served human health and socioeconomic sort of improvements in a lot of different places. But we know that they have produced inequalities produced marginalization and violence, produced sort of, you know, regional types of structural inequalities as well, which gave rise to structural violence. And now here is the thing, we're playing a fifth step in the Anthropocene. And that fifth step is really important and significant, and we're sort of downplaying its significance at the moment. We are not just trying to change energy systems because we know that fossils don't work. They produce climate change as a crisis. They produce pollution crises and biodiversity collapse. They produce planetary boundary crises, essentially. So we're trying to change our energy system because it's the main driver behind climate change and a number of ecological crises. But on the back of the energy change, we're also trying to open up a new sort of economic era, which is about digitalization and technological innovation and the so-called artificial intelligence. So how to enhance performance on the basis of a human template, but take it into a digital sphere, which will obviously, you know, and everybody's talking about it, right? Like the security risks or threats that are attached to that are, you know, a topic of discussion of itself. I won't touch on that. What I'm interested in is the narrative, which is about dematerialization, right? We're essentially saying we can do better, we can extract better, we can perform better on the back of having much less of an energy footprint and much less of a material footprint. But that's not true, because in order to change from a fossil system into a clean tech system or a sort of large infrastructure of clean tech and associated, you know, technologies, carbon-free or carbon-reduced technologies, we need to mine more. We need to mine vast amounts of materials. We don't really know how much yet because it depends on the sort of demand trajectories and scenarios. And on top of that, and that's the part that we're not really talking about, we're also sort of saying, well, we're going to create this digital era, which is dematerialized because everything is virtual. That's not true. That relies on massive architectural systems and infrastructures that are very material and energy intensive, and it's starting to bubble up as a narrative. And we're doing all of this at a moment when our planet is already in overshoot. And it's those sort of two images to respond, you know, like to sort of go full circle and to respond to your initial question, why are we in crisis? Well, we have legacy systems of extractions that have produced lots of violence, some of which have been interrogated, mitigated, or adapted to in certain circumstances. But most of all, we have legacy systems of violence and extraction. And we're now moving into a new era with those legacy systems, doubling down on extraction, doubling down on sort of potential inequalities and offshoots of violence around this. And we're doing this at a moment when we know that our planet is already in overshoot. We're already at 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming compared to pre-industrial levels. The latest research by James Hansen, you know, tells us we may be headed towards exponential rates of global warming and headed towards a 2-degree increase by the end of next decade. We have not resolved issues around global inequities, global problems of poverty. They're actually shooting back up. Violence in terms of conflict systems have been on the rise again since the Arab Spring, I think, was the sort of first start, like the years 2010, 2011. Since then, there's been more and more instability in the global international security system. And we're now collecting both the results of those inequality systems and a number of different sort of, well, sort of crumbling of the international security order. We're having new resource wars, and in the middle of that, that means that we're still using more and more energy and not really taking care of the climate crisis. So all of this is stacking up in terms of risks and coming at us with full rage in terms of how it makes a lot of things crumble, including, you know, what are the values that underpin international security system, which we thought were solid for a long time. And we, as it turns out, they're not.
Fascinating. Thank you. What an extraordinary run through of the past 10,000 years, essentially. Mm. And a very particular and yet global view of what's going on with regards to the energy transition and materials and minerals. It's just as a kind of aside, it's something I find deeply frightening actually doing this work, and how little consensus there seems to be around the energy transition. And even how narrative gets weaponized within this space with regards to, we must all pick a story. A renewable future is a story that the mainstream can get behind. And thus we all need to kind of just push through any squabbles about what is actually material available and what would be good for the planet in order to just get there. And when we're looking at, you know, mining set to increase by 60%, that's what the recent UN report said, and the catastrophic impacts that that would have on our ecosystems, biodiversity, the climate, thus our food systems, et cetera, et cetera. It seems yet another kind of symptom of dematerialism to be arguing that this is kind of, you know, ultimately it's the narrative that's most important here. I think what I'd be quite keen to pull out from all of this, before we go into international security, which I really would like to with you, but if we can just touch on this connection here between violence, domination, and dematerialism, because even going back to the agricultural revolution and the settlement, and thus kind of like the defining the definition of land as certain parcels with regards to how we relate to them, and thus them becoming like a narrative, the enslavement of animals, which would have produced, you know, a labor force, and thus kind of either elevates or reduces the material realm to the narrative realm, depending on, you know, how you want to look at it. And where we lead up to today with this really wildly inaccurate sense that we can digitalize our economy and keep growing forever because it's a virtual thing and thus will not have a significant impact on the planet. There seems to be a, how do I put this? There seems to be a sense of like profanity running through the past 10,000 years. An unwillingness to kind of engage with this connection between like spirit and matter and these things that are really, really present in indigenous wisdoms around the world. And yet something that physics is now only just beginning to grapple with in sort of the, you know, the quantum realm that everything is kind of connected. And that sort of rejection of the material world as anything other than its use, like useful work, leading to a very utilitarian perspective, which is, you know, well, we'll just do this violent thing. It doesn't really matter because it's only in this realm of the human experience. And also we're elevating things elsewhere. So when you balance it out, you are offsetting our harm in the name of progress.
And it's, again, that's the part where I ask myself the same kind of questions as you do, because I mean, I'll give a very personal example. My dad is a vet. He reveres science. And I've grown up in that environment where science is essentially understanding the microscopic, the very sort of minute type of relationships and how it gives us a window into a larger organization of the cosmos, almost, and, you know, planetary systems and sort of biology, physics, chemistry, everything. It's an extraordinary feat of human intelligence. And I think it's absolutely right to talk about it this way. It's not the type of systemic intelligence that indeed, you know, indigenous communities have at their core, and in the way that they behave also between each other and with the ecosystems that they inhabit. But it is a product of human intelligence. And it's important to see the good results out of that. And mm-hmm. in some ways, you know, like we've increased lifespans. We have understood health to be a key component of human dignity. And what it means to essentially sort of take the ability of human knowledge and human intelligence to exert itself in life, in the realm of life. The problem is indeed that it has produced essentially these massive blind spots, especially when we talk about the way in which linear thinking has evolved in Western societies. I don't know the full history of that, which I think is a sort of field of study worth really interrogating. Because a lot of people who study indigenous sort of sets of knowledge talk about how Western societies are disconnected from wider forms of wisdom and intelligence, and how those, you know, like are worth talking about, investigating, relating to. But I don't know where this mm-hmm. moment of disconnection happened. I don't know why it happened. I don't know if it had a reason to happen, because when we talk about the type of technological innovations that we tend to revere in Western societies and the sort of conventional sense of technical and technological progress, we tend to revere things that do not take into account in their design phase externalities. That's an economic theory, which we know very well about, but that's also just like an ecological one. In my research, for example, and this is why it's indeed, as you were saying, sort of a difficult topic of research. When you look at the three IPCC reports, there is the first one, which is the science of climate change. The second one is about adaptation. And the third one is about the economic case behind the energy transition and behind a number of climate-related transitions. Did you ever come across any IPCC report about the ecological costs of the energy transition?
Yeah.
No. Mm. And it's not to say that their work hasn't been extraordinary. It just means that there are some assumptions that produce themselves blind spots, and the blind spots can, because of the very thin margin or sort of space for maneuvering that we have for this energy transition, we cannot afford to discard externalities. We cannot afford to have a number of blind spots. It is a matter of absolute necessity to get all the dimensions of action right, including the ones that you don't necessarily sort of think of in the first place. When you think through your lens of disciplinarity, can be climate science, but then if it excludes potentially the biodiversity aspect or indigenous knowledge, then you sort of miss huge areas of questions which help to calibrate the wisdom of your recommended action even better. And that's still, you know, like the sort of fundamental problems that we operate with in any type of action. Same thing, like, you know, I was just telling you before we started recording that I work with Professor James Dyke from the University of Exeter. We partner on a number of projects. One of them is a research about geoengineering. Geoengineering is one of the ultimate forms of technological innovation that people are talking about at the moment when applied to climate interventions, for how to deploy planetary sorts of technological intervention to try and mitigate the effects of climate change, not the drivers of climate change, the effects of climate change. So we may be talking about solar radiation management in various forms, right? Either you deploy a massive umbrella between the sun and planet Earth in order to sort of shield planet Earth from some of the sun rays, or you seed the atmosphere with like diamond dust or sulfides, right? Like, and you do it at a planetary scale, which takes us to a new position, which also, you know, like we can come back to it, but it's it takes us to a position as humans of being planetary stewards when we don't have the full wisdom, sets of knowledge and data sets that would allow us to understand what planetary stewardship or management should look like, or what, best template or values to follow, right? But we're already there, right? Like we've had such a massive impact throughout our history as a human species that we're now sort of saying, yes, 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 we can manage planet Earth. And, we can manage planet Earth on top of it in our relationship to space, and how to mine on the moon, and how to mine on asteroids, and how to build the sort of infrastructure and sort of the machines that would allow us to do this planetary management taking the relationship to space into account. So even sort of taking humans out of their planetary realm themselves. But the reason why I talk about this is because as a result of the latest IPCC findings last year, it became quite clear that geoengineering was integrated within their recommended sets of action. But same thing, did you find anywhere a study of what deploying geoengineering technologies would do to the planet, or what material inputs would be needed to build the fleet of technologies that we need in order to manage the planet? No. Mm-hmm. And all of these blind spots, looking at, input/output/externality, all of these different things now need to be taken into account, because at the moment we're having all of these conversations which are fundamentally existential. That's why and I'm amongst them. I'm a very passionate person, or people tell me that I'm very passionate. I'm mobilized in the face of the issues that we're talking about is more how I would describe it, right? But there's a huge level of passion because everybody in their own way is in connection with this notion of we're talking about existential issues. We're either talking about the future of humans surviving in planet Earth or on planet Earth, or parts of humanity when we want to sort of be very cynical about the conversation. People like Elon Musk, I think, have this sense that a person like him understood the problems, the sets of problem very well. He's just kind of looking at space as a potential solution, not really asking all the questions about whether or not you can take billions of humans to space altogether, right? Mm. But I think that everybody has, this sense of I need to find a solution, and I'm going to sort of deploy my own energy, my own sets of knowledge to try and find that solution. And I've decided to sort of focus on the sort of, in my own research, the part that is absolutely sort of horrendous in terms of how it rubs against everybody else's skin, to sort of say, yes, but look at this externality. Does it question the entire rationale for how we do things, at least partially? And therefore, how do we recalibrate the sets of recommended actions towards something that actually makes sense from a collective, humane, humanistic, and wise perspective? And how can we get that relationship between the nature part of humanity and the technological part of humanity right? Which is, I think, what we're also sort of playing out as a massive issue within the next 10 to 15 years, right? It's not just the energy transition. We focus on that, but really fundamentally, it's this notion of how do we manage our footprint and our outputs is one way to look at it. And when we look at it this way, it's also how do we manage this notion of what is nature's place in our own nature as humans? And what is the place of technology as a way to enhance this nature? And we're kind of losing the plot at the moment in that conversation, because we're focusing on the enhancement part, which interestingly, and I'll end on that because, I feel like we could just sort of go in so many different directions. But to go back to the whole aspect of domestication of animals as a way to sort of harness one specific type of energy. I was also reading recently Yuval Harari's Homo Deus, and he makes such an interesting point about some of the risks associated to the development of AI, which we tend to conceptualize as potentially an intelligence that goes even further than human intelligence. And if we want to have an inkling as to what the consequences may be for humans, we may need to look back at how humans have actually treated other types of intelligence already on the planet, including animals and including vegetation. And if we look at the social hierarchy and the violence that we've produced, we may have actually a template, or, you know, that's part of how he imagines things, right? It may actually serve as a template for how really advanced forms of artificial intelligence may treat humans. And that gives a completely different perspective on how we want to deal with violence when we start being on the receiving end of it.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because at the moment, the conversation is kind of like, oh, it's coded for bias. Careful about that. It's also probably going to be coded for violence, exactly as you say, because it's the ultimate dematerialized source of knowledge, isn't it? And thus, you know, if you follow that hierarchy of, you know, thinking that the that rocks are dead and that plants don't have consciousness and that animals have consciousness, but they're not intelligent. And then that humans have consciousness and are intelligent, but they still have a body. You know, so an AI would be the ultimate form of being in this hierarchical dematerialized system that we've created.
Yeah. And they have a limited sense of intelligence, right? Like when it comes to understanding, for example, how to deal with resources, a lot of people will tell you, well, we can't do any type of behavioral change in societies. It's too hard. It's going to take too long. And nobody will agree because there are too many differences within the sort of human palette. So that's why we focus on technology. And technology is about how to deal with resources in a very efficient way.
No, please.
Because humans are limited in their ability to agree with one another and to be efficient and to be effective and to be wise. So we're going to delegate that to machines that are not looking at all the cultural differences or maybe looking at them, but doing, you know, like dealing with them in a more sort of efficient way and are going to choose the optimal type of solution. But optimality is also a value proposition, which is that you don't necessarily always know what the sort of assumptions underpinning optimality are and who they're going to serve best and who they may not serve all that well and whether or not they may produce indeed certain types of violence. And the whole question is how, you know, like that's also the worry that I have in my research. When you look at all the, you know, when we go back on this history of the Anthropocene and the four steps, the scope of violence, the possibility and potential for violence increased at every step. And culminated indeed, you know, like, and I suppose that this is partially why the Anthropocene Working Group sort of debates are so interesting. If it culminated with tests of nuclear technologies, it shows this sort of ability of humans to produce extraordinary forms of innovation on the back of science, which have these dual uses, right? For civilian purposes, for energy purposes, because nuclear energy at the end of the day remains the most concentrated form of energy, even more so than fossils. But then it also gave the ability to develop weapons of mass destruction and to allow us to live under what we call the Age of Terror, which is essentially you've got enough nuclear arsenals in different parts of the world, enough to destroy the Earth multiple times over. And what protects us is actually the terror induced by using those things, which calls on political leaders or societies to deal with reason as a precautionary principle. But that's very brittle.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't sound like the best, you know, emotional math equation, using terror as the impetus to call on our rational thinking, because I'm pretty sure most, you know, psychologists would tell you that terror would typically trigger a reduction in our, you know, brain's capacity to respond to a situation. You're going from the rationality of the prefrontal cortex right back into the lizard, you know, fight or flight response. And especially given what you were saying about this kind of, let's call it like a, you know, a politics of dematerialism, all it takes is for somebody whose religious fervor is connected with their political power, and we are seeing that more and more, to decide that it doesn't really matter if we destroy the earth many times over, because right. there's another realm where the good people, where the followers will be entitled to. And actually, that actually also deals with, you know, with the scourge of everyone else who doesn't follow that line of thinking as well.
Yes, I wonder about this. I have, you know, some concerns about this as well, particularly like I wonder about the whole narrative about transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
Which indeed is at the core of this notion of dematerialization, right? But it takes it into another realm where essentially it's like how to be human without having a body. I think it was Zuckerberg which said, like, I want a world where I'm rid of the weight of my physicality. And again,
so funny. It's somebody so skinny saying that.
Sure. Right. And I mean, don't quote me on the exact wording. I think that's what it, you know, like sort of, you know, stuck in my mind, you know, this notion of like the weight of physicality is such a strange thing, because to me, at least my experience of being human is having a body and having senses associated to that body is one of the most important ways in which I can experience the world and experience my own relationship to the world and what it means, therefore, to develop my own sense of humanity, because it's an experience and it's never a set, at least for me, it's not a set. It's not something set in stone. It's something that is rich and learning throughout a life, right? And senses are so important to that. I mean, like, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, like, not that I want to reduce it to something so simple as that, but I'm French. My sense of taste, my sense of gourmandise, you say, it's just fundamental to the way that I experience life, right? It's just like, take that away from me. And then all of a sudden, I'm just kind of like, but what's the point? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, you know, like the likes of Zuckerberg will invent something that can somehow reproduce the feelings or some neurological connections as to what sensations and senses can create in terms of experience. But I'm not entirely sure I understand why we need to reproduce it when we have it as an innate mechanism in the first place. That indeed, and this is also part of the full comparison also between indigenous sets of knowledge and this sort of philosophy, which is now culminating in some kind of religion with transhumanism, the materiality, the physicality is just, it's a fundamental way of being, not just doing. It's a fundamental sort of component of belonging to the sort of, you know, realm of nature, which is both physical and indeed, I'm not sure what other word to use. Conceptual may be one of them, but conceptual resonates a bit more with Western philosophies around science. I think that you use those sort of, you know, matter and spirit type of relationship before. And I think that this is right, without necessarily ascribing a religious or dogmatic, you know, sort of content to the word spirit. It's just like this notion that there's always more than physicality, actually. And it doesn't, if we can't see it or measure it, it doesn't mean that it's not there either.
But also, it doesn't mean that we can access it without our materiality. Because exactly as you're saying, this is how we make sense of the word. And I'm so glad you've used that expression, because I've been sort of obsessed for the past week with this idea of making sense and things being sensed, and yet other things that we experience with our bodies being senseless. So we talk a lot about how violence is senseless because we can't make sense of it. And yet it is something that is fundamentally sensed. Even if you want to talk about political violence, such as oppression or emotional violence, there are reactions in our nervous system. It's still a really, really embodied politics. And so I am particularly fascinated with Silicon Valley, which is kind of the apex, say, of the quest for dematerialization, plus incredible energy use, plus consciousness, this obsession that they have towards it, they want to make sense of the world by losing their senses. I mean, how could we possibly? That is senseless. And this is an ultimate form of senseless violence. There will be a violence there, the severing of this attempt to understand spirit, you know, the severing of the spirit from the materiality, into which I genuinely believe all meaning will fall. Because even though we are conceptual, as you're saying, even though we have this phenomenal capacity to reify concepts and language, which is part of the reason I think, you know, why we're here, despite all of that, if you take away our tongues, how do we speak? If you take away our feeling, how do we know how to interpret the world? If you take away our capacity to feel warmth, to feel a hug, to feel laughter in our bellies, what is there left anymore to express, to experience? How is it that we connect into the world? Exactly as you're saying. And it's like, what is it like? I watched the film Mother the other night for the second time. Have you not seen it? Mother, exclamation point.
I need to watch it.
You do need to watch it. It's by Darren Aronofsky. And I'm going to spoil it a little bit, if I may, but that will not take away from watching it. And it's meant to be about the environment. It's meant to be about planet Earth and possibly this other, you know, this male patriarchal kind of creator god. And the tension is essentially between that she has made this home for him in which he is struggling to write. And she builds this huge home for them. She fills it. It's so welcoming. It's so beautiful. She works and she works and she works while he sits and sits and sits with a pen in his hand and can't produce anything. And then eventually she falls pregnant. And to cut a long story short, it's just not enough for him. So this life that is growing within her, that is their co-creation, is nothing for him compared to the proprietorial creation that he has over his poetry, essentially. And he chooses his poetry and his art, his words, and the impact that that has on the world around him over this fundamentally kind of like collaborative, difficult to understand, but fundamentally like biological thing that they do together. And I, just to be clear, I'm not elevating the sense of, you know, like biological co-creation, you know, reproduction as like the ultimate thing of what humanity can do. But to me, it revealed this kind of, again, this sense of individualism and how perhaps like technological innovation, because obviously language, writing, that is also a technology.
Yeah.
We prize and value that which we have a sense of proprietorial ownership over rather than that which is done in collaboration. And so, you know, this body that, you know, we are born with, that we do not choose, is kind of this like ultimate anchor to a sense of collectivism and a sense of, I mean, for me, joy and empowerment and embodiedness, but perhaps for other people, a sense of disempowerment or lack of agency. Because you can choose your mind in a, well, you know, vaguely, but you can really, you can harness your mind, you can change your mind, you can weaponize your mind, you can update your mind. But your body is kind of, that's what you are born with. There's no choice there. And so there's this like transhumanism is really this like desire to optimize the human experience and kind of inject it with technological whatever. To me, it doesn't scream progress in the sense of, oh, we want to make, you know, life better for humanity. Because if that's the case, go and give water to people that don't have it. Go and ask for a ceasefire and go and give food. Like, it's obviously not about, you know, humanity in the global sense. But to me, it's very much about a deep, 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 deep desire to have like ultimate creative control over what we do. But as long as we reject the biological material realm for that, it will only ever produce death in a sense. It will only ever contribute towards the economy of death.
Well, it would certainly produce some of that economy, that's for sure. I think for me, you know, the thing that I find interesting in what you just brought up, including, you know, this I haven't seen the movie, but I can imagine a man who's trying to sort of sit at his desk and sort of, you know, laboring away and just being in sort of existential angst over not being able to produce, mm-hmm. you know, like his art, his like ultimate contribution to the world where a lot of things are happening around. Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting thing that I think that we're also missing to a certain extent in that sort of whole conversation about dematerialization, is that we're also, our intelligence depends on relationality, right?
Yes.
So because I, like, you know, you told me that you're in the midst of writing. I do my fair bit as well. I know that if I sit down at my desk for hours on end, without sort of feeding my brain, my body, my senses, my soul with outside input, my writing is going to be sort of quite, I want to say constipated. It's going to be sort of like heavy, right? It doesn't have this notion of flow to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is, you know, like what we're talking about in all of those sort of, you know, topic that we're trying to address, you know, like materiality and violence and sort of relationship to one another and stuff like this. We are so little aware of the fact that our own sense of intelligence is not an island. It is a relational possibility. We can only ever, you know, grow more and more intelligent on the basis of, well, for example, the conversation that we're having right now, which I will come out of it more intelligent because of you, right? And I will probably sort of, you know, come out of a day of working a lot healthier and a lot more inspired if I at least sort of, you know, go and walk outside or that kind of thing. And it sounds very trivial to talk about it this way, but if you extrapolate it to much, like to very existential questions, it's still valid. I'll give this example of geoengineering again, right? Imagine a world where essentially we fail, you don't need to imagine it, we're in it. We're failing to mitigate climate change and we're very quickly moving to considering the active deployment of planetary technologies. The planetary technologies, depending on which one you talk about, may end up actually sort of, in the worst case scenario, turning our skies white or some kind of gray, right?
God.
And if you think of this and you think of the story of art production and the history of mankind, paintings, poems, photography, anything that essentially appeals to the relationship between man or woman and mankind, humankind, and the sense of achievements, the sense of inspiration, the sense of beauty, it's actually profoundly related to the external environment that we relate to and that we measure ourselves against. Mm-hmm. This notion of, you know, like flying was inspired because of a sense of freedom that we could imagine on the basis of how it would feel to be in the sky and to experience all of this realm that we don't know. And Da Vinci, you know, sort of invented it on this basis, right? Like tried to go into his engineering part of his mind, which was only there because he had a dream which was projected onto the skies. And if you look at some of the most beautiful paintings in the story of humanity, a lot of paintings come with a lot of contrasts. If light is blocked at the entry point, which is the sky, which is, you know, the relationship between the sun and the earth, you don't get a lot of contrast in your environment. That means that you don't get a lot of contrast in your mind via your senses. It means that you're diminished and poorer for it, right? So I'm sort of like, I know that we're having a very sort of conceptual or sort of metaphysical conversation on the back of what it means to keep on using technologies almost to simplify the complexity that actually nourishes us. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that I don't get into the whole sort of, you know, concept of transhumanism or how to use technology to enhance and optimize for human performance, which obviously I can't help but to sort of, you know, tilt also on the very sort of masculine sort of charge to all of these sort of, you know, sets of language and vocabularies. But even, you know, sort of not fully engaging with that conversation, which again takes us to another part of, you know, potential sort of value systems and that kind of thing, is just why, what exactly are you trying to enhance and optimize for? Because at the moment, the conversation is very much related when it comes to economic markets, for example, is very much related to how to optimize performance at work and therefore labor efficiency or effectiveness and that kind of thing. Fine. Okay, let's roll with that for a second. During the Industrial Revolution in the UK, when there were lots of changes happening as a result of the introduction of the steam engine and coal to sort of enhance textile sector performance and that kind of thing, what we realized was actually at the time that the notion of performance and the notion of progress needed to be embedded into social constructions. Quite literally, there were a lot of labor capacity that was moving to cities. Cities were not optimized for that amount of people who were arriving. There were lots of health issues, lots of crime issues. And so all of a sudden, what the innovation that was needed was something about how to think through the templates of cities differently, how to think in terms of health as a ratio between the capacity that a human is able to give to their economic activity and how they can recover from that activity so as to sustain entire sectors, and how to have a relationship which is actually going to be based on this relationship. What you give is also what you're going to take and what you're going to receive in order to create a society that actually makes sense. And one of the things that was perfected over time, especially in the sort of this era of Industrial Revolution, is how you could indeed, on top of it, have societies which used economic performance to create societal projects that were considered to be ahead of progress. Progress understood in terms of a multidimensional sense of progress. Are we seeing that today with AI? I don't get this sense, right? It seems that some technologies can be applied to how to, you know, again, do sort of resource efficiency and allocation better. Not just natural resource, but let's say in a hospital, how to sort of use specific sort of parts of the hospital and labor in the hospital better. But it's essentially applying efficiency measures to a system which is, again, already an overshoot. So what we're trying to do is just fundamentally extract more. And I'm not entirely sure how this is redistributed into a system that needs to be transformed because a new technology is coming in and is transforming the mental, physical, and sort of conceptual landscape of what it means to be human and how to interact amongst humans and between humans and their wider environment. That's the conversation that I'm missing. At the moment, we're just kind of blindly going into a vastly competitive conversation, which is applied from one sector to the other, which pits certain parts of labor forces one against the other. And if you extrapolate it again, you know, to international security realms, it's how to have a race to the best technologies and the most transformative technologies from one country to the other, which actually creates a race to the bottom because there are no safeguards and rail guards on how technologies are going to what they're going to be used for. But on top of it, we have no regard whatsoever on what this competition will create in terms of resource scrambling, which is where you find the equation at the moment where violence is likely to come in most quickly and most and with most impact because the resource base is already very poor and the planetary carrying capacity is so small that it cannot actually support what we're calling now the fourth industrial revolution. It's almost as if you're trying to create this ever-expanding funnel on an ever-decreasing natural base, which is going to manifest via water scarcity, soil and land use scarcity, and which on top of it is going to be not just sprinkled, showered with climate disruptions and human sort of movements as a result of, you know, adaptive mechanisms.
And I'm reminded of what you said at the beginning, which is that at every stage of this Anthropocene, the potential and the impact of violence was bigger. And if we thought nukes were scary, and which had a hugely devastating impact on the human and more than human world, to think about what this then would be in a planet that is scarce, as you're saying, it's a terrifying concept. And I guess it leads on to, and perhaps this is a question about international security. Beyond, you know, beyond systems, beyond impetus for economic growth, beyond reification, beyond, you know, having idiots in charge, beyond all of that stuff, why don't we just stop?
Because competition is at the heart of the balance of power. And balance of power is something organic. It changes over time. It changes across eras. And countries or societies that have momentary upper hands or lose in the balance of power try to sort of regain or impose their societal templates very often via means of control and means of extraction, which are doubled down. And that usually leads to, well, very intense competitions around values, around more value systems, around what are the rules that underpin global international security systems. Who do they serve, and whether or not there can be enough of a sort of equalized, not equal, but sort of relative balance of power to try and sort of see whether or not to build an inclusive international security system. And at the moment, and again, it goes back to the whole point of having a sort of planet in crisis and what's playing out in this planet in crisis. The whole sort of technological conversation, digitalization, you fourth industrial revolution, is essentially the sign of a new system, systems of rivalries and rivalries of systems, which produce competition and which produce material extraction. And this is what produces resource scrambling. It's a pattern of the past. We keep on repeating it. And in some ways, you know, like it's very, again, like it's this, it's, there is an element which is difficult, right? Because first of all, at the moment, it's a bit difficult to sort of understand what are the values at stake. Are we talking about open societies? Are we talking about, you know, sort of stakes of control, about democracies versus autocracies? Is there a clear-cut line between the various systems? Because usually systems in competition actually adopt means that change their very sort of internal composition as well. To give but one example, you know, like the US, for example, looks at China and says, well, it's an authoritarian system bordering in some cases on totalitarian system. And it is a system of control which essentially sort of decides to reduce or diminish or prohibit individual liberties and societal freedoms on account of economic performance and potential sort of, you know, technological or techno-enabled forms of control at the highest level, at the sort of central level, the Chinese Communist Party. It's not very, you know, it's not a very pretty image. I'm, you know, at least I can speak in my name. I'm not really inclined, or I'm not in favor of living in a society where, well, where it's totalitarian. Especially, you know, when we look at, and particularly sort of looking into the social credit system in China at the moment, I find it disturbing. But if you look at the US, so it's, you know, a country which is a global superpower on many accounts, which stands, which has a narrative standing up for freedoms and democracy. When you look at the state of democracy in the US at the moment, there are legitimate questions to ask. You don't need to be, you know, Mr. Putin or Mr. Xi to sort of look at what's happening and be like, are you sure that this is the system that you want to defend? But it's not just that. It's also, you know, when you look at the model essentially around technological actors, they're from the private sector. They talk a lot about, you know, new forms of discoveries and conquest, the spatial conquest and sort of, you know, like this notion of techno-optimization, mostly for economic performance and that kind of thing. And then sort of talking about this sort of grand new era of human potential. But in reality, you know, the kind of technologies that they're also sort of developing have some impacts, have some sort of results, which very well, you know, may be ascribed to techno-controlled or techno-enabled societies, which at the end of the day, when you place them in a system of competition, where it's not exactly mean what ends you're defending, and therefore what means you're willing to use, and how far you're willing to push those means, you don't exactly know where the danger comes from. Is it going to be essentially the means that create societies that may, for example, return to new forms of totalitarianism? Are they going to come from China? Are they going to come from actors that essentially claim to fight the Chinese model and to protect civil liberties or political liberties? All of this is just, you know, like we're, and that's the part that I find particularly worrying, and which is a sign again of, you know, like we're in a transition period. It's not just an energy transition period. It's not just a digital transition period. It is a geopolitical transition. It is a societal transition. It is a values transition. And it is a sort of relational transition. And when, like, it's relational in terms of our relationship to nature, our relationship to technology, our relationship to each other, our relationship to ourselves, when you, you know, sprinkle that conversation about transhumanism on top of it.
So with this question, where are we headed? I think that we need to ask ourselves the question of how do we build peace on the back of all of these transitions? How do we question what peace is made of today? What it needs to be made of tomorrow, because as we hit the 1.5 threshold, as we accelerate towards the 2-degree threshold, we are entering unknown territory. Scientists are asking a lot of questions as to what that will mean in terms of a safe space for humanity, if it exists, and if it exists, what it is made of. And that means that a number of stuff that have underpinned this notion of international security and peace systems in the last 80 years have to transition themselves. And that is, I think, the question that at least I don't see a lot of people sort of picking up on this dimension of what we're up against. We still look at all of these transitions from a very technical perspective. But in fact, we're going through a massive set of transformations. And we will only come out on the other side of these transformations with a sense of, I think, humanity, as we were talking about it in, you know, in the last hour and something. By asking these questions of what do we do collectively to face these challenges. And obviously, like, you know, like as we're going, like the difficulty at the moment is that as we're going through these transitions and as the notion of power and the balance of power is being sort of recast, questioned, argued over, fought over, we don't have a lot of sense of collective. And this is what is at stake for how we come out on the other side. So the next, let's say, 10 to 15 years, which is essentially like, you know, the period that we have to sort of redesign supply chains that will sort of, you know, take us on the other side of this energy system to try and sort of, you know, put fossils back where they belong in, you know, historical and geological strata and in human history. Well, those 10 to 15 years are essentially like along the supply chains for critical minerals that will create the backbone for the next energy architecture. This is how we will sort of negotiate the future of peace, the future of international security. And this is why so many tensions are coming to the fore at the moment. It's a lot of things which are being renegotiated, questioned, and argued over.
And are any of these conversations fruitful? Or is there still a general assumption that if competition is at the heart of the balance of power, as you said earlier, then it is, nobody wants to perform heart surgery on that balance of power?
Heart surgery, like, it's more, in my view, that's more that the heart surgery is being performed, but not every surgeon argues on the course of action in the room. It's more that we risk essentially competition at the moment between a number of, you know, global superpowers or middle powers is leading to a massive risk of resource scrambling. Mm-hmm. And the resource scrambling is coming up in many different conversations, right? Like it's coming out through the lens of resource nationalism or protectionism in some cases. You can see it, for example, in the European Union and the US that are trying to sort of de-risk. It's not about decoupling from China anymore, which holds a lot of monopoly or at least dominance over a number of critical supply chains. Starting from extraction, but also sort of massively over processing and then sort of deploying those massive technologies that risk sort of crashing certain key sectors that are considered to be really important for the political economies of certain countries, from Germany to, you know, the US and others. And so it's not about decoupling anymore because that's virtually quasi impossible. It's about de-risking, and de-risking is about diversification. So you look essentially at how to create new relationships between, well, you know, if I look at the EU has struck a number of strategic partnerships with countries like Kazakhstan, Namibia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, Chile, is questioning also, you know, like the sort of content of trade partnerships with countries in Latin America or with Central Asian countries. But the thing that I find a little bit disconcerting at the moment is that supply chains are really seen primarily and quite in a shadow way through industrial and energy security prisms. For both, you know, like the demand countries, so in, you know, in the case of the EU or, you know, the US or Canada, or in the, like, you know, for sort of mitigation providers or suppliers of critical minerals in countries like Namibia. So it's really still sort of, you know, looking at, let's use the supply chains to diversify from an economic perspective, from an energy perspective, to try and sort of, you know, de-risk global supply chains from over-dominance of one actor, because we can roll with interdependency. We cannot roll with over-dominance or dependency, full point. But the problem is that we're not yet really thinking about how to use the redesigning of supply chains for multiple sort of outputs on security, multiple gains on security. I'll give an example. Namibia is a country which is quite water vulnerable, which is climate vulnerable, which has an energy system that does not serve all of its citizens just yet, which suffers in some circumstances from high levels of poverty in certain pockets of populations. You can argue essentially that Namibia, wanting to position itself as a forefront actor of the green economy for hydrogen, for critical minerals, for all of these different things, that, well, the countries that essentially are interested in Namibia should essentially sort of create an offer that goes beyond just extraction, right? And looks at, for example, regeneration methodologies to accompany extraction, because otherwise water resources may be compromised even more as part of the extractive sort of process. And then it's about how to participate and contribute to the development of grids in Namibia that also connect with South Africa and with the region, that try to essentially sort of give birth to a bioregional specialization in energy rather than on the basis of primary materials and economic diversification, right? We need to now look not just at the availability of resources, but what those resources are part of in terms of the regional climate system, the natural resource system, and how to sort of create a balance between all of this. And then there is obviously all the question about how to support different types of trade relationships with countries like Namibia, but for that matter, with every country around the world. And whether or not the pace and content of trade relationships will stand the test of the climate disruptions that are coming at us at a raging pace. When I was in Chile, you know, typically Chile is a country that relies on critical minerals, particularly copper and lithium, as export commodities. It also relies on agriculture, particularly around vineyards. It relies on timber. It relies on salmon fisheries, right? You can argue that all of these sectors are quite extractive, with different levels of extraction, with different footprints in terms of extraction. But all of them have a very heavy toll on the environment. Chile is a country that is water challenged, particularly in the high north, that is going to be climate challenged as a result of, you know, wildfires and droughts and that kind of thing. And if you essentially sort of, you know, if Chile keeps on locking itself, for example, in export-oriented economies that rely on those extractive sectors that give in quite a lot of economic dividend, but don't actually sort of, you know, take into account the regenerative aspect and the sort of extraction rate of water resources and the toll that they inflict on the environment as a result of, or in, you know, in relation with the climate hazards, then 5, 10, 15 years from now, we may end up having a country that sort of rode the wave of those 10 to 15 years that are so important, so critical to the energy transition, and that are going to have such a high toll in terms of extraction. But on the other side of that, their economic gains will be spent on trying to sort of mitigate the impacts of climate hazards or all the socioeconomic tipping points that they will go through. So what's the point, right? If we don't preempt this before, we don't take it into the design of how we discuss all of those reorganizations of supply chains, then we're actually not really thinking about a so-called climate safe future. Which in the grand narrative was always mostly associated to, well, in order to have a climate safe future, we need an energy transition. And that is, you know, a climate safe future is going to be equated with peace as well. It makes perfect sense. But if you actually sort of look into the minutiae of that equation, you realize that those 10 to 15 years when the energy transition happens, which comes on the back also of all these other transitions that we talk about, peace is looking into what peace is, how it connects to economics, how it connects to international security, how it connects to political economies at domestic levels or regional levels. This is what will create a climate safe future. And if we don't ask those questions, then we may very well go into a future where the energy transition will have equated maybe with more climate safety gains, but will have created such fundamental shifts and ruptures and given rise to emerging fault lines from a geopolitical, security, socioeconomic, societal, digital sort of security perspective, that it will not be a peaceful future. It will be actually a sort of relatively climate safe future, but one where
certain preconditions around what peace, you know, certain preconditions that give rise to peace and safety and freedoms to actually experience humanity, as we were saying, and to grow humanity will simply not be there. They will not be part of the equation. And if we don't go there, then again, the competition will come across, right? It will actually give rise to yet other waves of extractivisms, other waves of geospatial and geostrategic expansion to try and create a balance of power that remains very unstable. So all of these questions are barely emerging right now. They are, in my view, some of the most fundamental questions that need to be there, not just to accompany the energy transition, but to underpin it, to create a sort of safety cordon around it, and to use the energy transition as a process that allows us to go into a world where we look at this notion of collective security through different eyes that are sort of updated in what security needs to be made of today and tomorrow and as we transition towards all of this. And for the moment, the supply chain reorganization is starting, but it's not going far enough because, well, I think that the understanding of how much of a transformation, how deep of a transformation we're going through is not quite there yet. And I think that we're confusing, we're not very organized and structured and clear-headed in terms of what geopolitics, how geopolitics is meddling with all of this and where geopolitics are headed as well.
The thing that I love around the idea of redesigning supply chains is that it takes a problem that seems so complex and says there is a way to start bottom up, in a sense. I wrote this line recently that infrastructure is the trellis around which society grows. We don't have to start with these huge concepts of what a global economy would necessarily look like, or what a global politics would look like, or even what a climate safe, a conceptually climate safe environment would look like, peace even, but designing our infrastructure differently so that we can respond to our own environment and grow a new environment. It suddenly makes these things seem more feasible, both with regards to taking a lot of action very quickly, but also with being able to have conversations and agree with one another and understand one another.
Yes, and what I love about the way that you look at it is that it starts by asking the right questions. And it's about asking those questions of what does security look like in a country like Namibia? I keep on saying this, for example, in the various forums where I go at the moment in Europe, where they're all about saying we want to de-risk. And I was like, great. Ask what de-risking means for the supply countries, not just for countries in Europe or in the US or anywhere else, which are essentially the energy intensive countries or industry intensive countries in terms of output and economic performance. And then by asking those questions and looking at, well, here we need more climate security sort of activities or sort of, you know, resilience beefing up. Here we need to look at, we need to pay more attention to water. Here we need to pay attention to sort of issues around inequality, more socioeconomic types of sort of, you know, policies. How do we go about doing, you know, sort of interventions that help to essentially sort of build up climate adaptation potential and therefore climate security overall? How do we build this bioregional specialization, these links between different neighbors in different regions that will be on the receiving end of different types of disruptions? And then all of a sudden, you can have a conversation about, well, what are the things that China can contribute to, that the US can contribute to, that EU countries can contribute to, that Saudi Arabia, Turkey, India, Russia can contribute to. By creating those sort of, you know, ecosystems of collective
reciprocity.
Reciprocity, or even just, you know, mutual sort of build up, right? I don't think, for example, at the moment that a country like France would necessarily sort of want to sort of have discussions in certain countries with Russia, let's say. But you can have parallel types of sort of, you know, like formulas where over time what emerges is something that is, that creates by process more stability and therefore more ability to sort of, you know, create this notion of what is the coexistence. That said, and I mean, like, you know, this is the part where we would need another like 3 hours to discuss the ins and outs of what I'm about to say. But the people who will listen to the podcast that we're recording, I suspect, are people who are quite aware that because we are hitting biophysical limits, we have a time risk. I was talking, for example, to a person yesterday who does studies on deep sea ecology and who looks at the issues around deep sea mining, right? Who tries to collect data about what happens in ecosystems that are so little known to humanity. He was telling me, well, we know that deep sea ecosystems are going to be just so greatly impacted by climate change, 6 to 10 years maximum from now. 6 to 10 years is a very little amount of time to think about how to redesign an international sort of security system or collective security system or that kind of thing. So we have to, like, you know, we can't sort of, every question comes in its due time, but there are some questions that we need to preempt at the moment because of the sort of time risk component that climate change brings about. So I still hold the view that the bottom-up approach that you're talking about and sort of striking the bottom-up approach with a good understanding of the questions that you need to ask and what you need to accompany sort of, you know, supply chain redesign with in terms of interventions, in terms of offers, in terms of like large sort of, you know, multidimensional offers and competitivity. All of this needs to happen. It needs to be nudged, needs to be accelerated. But we may quickly come to a moment of history where we need to table the question as to whether or not we need to have international negotiations over the use of energy and the sort of rate of material extraction, something different than what is currently taking place in COPs, for example, climate-related COPs, which are about negotiations over how fast and how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but which produce essentially ambition plans that are simply not in line with the urgency of climate change by now. It's too early to ask this question. I table it now because I know that, you know, when I look at all the stakes that we have to look at, it keeps on being something that, you know, sort of comes back very quickly in the analysis. And which we don't really have a template for in the history of humanity, because energy has always been a sovereign competency. It's actually the way in which you can deliver on political economic gains and on this notion of balance of power. And it's sort of, you know, looking at the problems that we've been discussing almost from the flip side, right? Looking at the role of energy in providing welfare, but also being at the heart of really important competitions, which can produce violence, which can produce global structural inequalities, as we've talked about, and forms of structural violence. And we now have to look at it in the sense of energy not just providing welfare, but indeed producing risks of a global scale
which are questioning how to do welfare, how to do stability, how to do security. And, you know, to sort of loop it back up, a lot of people are saying, well, geoengineering, right? It's going to be this thing of like, we can't expect humanity to discuss something that has never really been discussed in the past 5,000, 8,000 years. And so it's going to be easier to resort to technological fixes or research that may lead us to another step in human evolution and human politics. But for now, we have no reasons to believe that geoengineering technologies will save the day. We have no reasons to believe that they will not produce more risks than gains. And so we may be reaching essentially this boundary as well as to how much technology can save the day. And therefore, it may force us into a situation of grappling with our own limitations, our own shortcomings, and deal with them in a different way, right? Like, I have, again, it's a very metaphysical question. Are we reaching essentially a moment of history where we can't sort of find the technological vessels that allow us to leap into another era of human development? And are those physical boundaries, those biophysical boundaries that we're hitting, are they going to question the way in which we deal with each other and with the sense of humanity that we want to, that we've tried over time to cultivate, including via certain sort of complex political systems? Voila. I think that this is the extent of my questions for the day.
Eh ben, dis donc. Olivia, yeah. I mean, wow. What a tour. The A to Z and whatever else is on the other axis. That felt like a very three-dimensional conversation. Thank you so, so much. It was such a joy speaking with you. Absolutely. My final question for you is, who would you like to platform?
Oh, the first person who comes to mind is one of the women I admire most in this life. Her name is Natalie Topa. She's a boots on the ground kind of woman. She's worked in a lot of different places around the globe, in Yemen, in Burundi, in Uganda, working with displaced communities, with regenerative processes and methodologies that allow people who are experiencing lots of different types of vulnerabilities to become actors of their own journey, to cultivate more food security, more resilience when international systems kind of let them down. And she has an understanding of what complex regeneration should look like, which goes beyond, you know, when we talk about regeneration, a lot of people think, oh, let's plant trees. And that's going to be great for carbon sequestration. And, you know, like, we like green, so let's do that. Whereas what we're facing again at the moment is, you know, like a world which is in transition itself, right? Like, ecosystems are on the move, species are on the move, biophysical systems, climate regimes are on the move. So what we need is essentially to understand what regeneration looks like from a contextual perspective, not just from an ecological perspective, but the relationship with humans as well. And how to harness the power of water and the full hydrological cycle to try and sort of replant water as much as possible into soils, try to stabilize our relationship to water security, and try to sort of take some charge away from the atmospheric system and the role of water vapor in accelerating heat dynamics and in holding more heat within the atmosphere, and try to sort of bring it back down where it belongs and where it can favor more safety, more security over health, over food production, over disaster buffering, over all of these things. And her work has inspired me in a lot of ways to think of complex regeneration at a more planetary scale and to try and sort of counter this current sort of technoplanetary management type of vision by geoengineering, right? I think that we will have to evolve over time to this notion of planetary management, but cultivating different forms of wisdom, as we were saying, different forms of intelligence, different forms of data, different forms of relationship to each other and to the land needs to be at the very sort of foundation of how we do some kind or some form or shape of planetary management. And her work gives birth to the beginning of this reflection.
Amazing. I cannot wait to speak with her. Olivia, thank you so much for today, for your time, for your words, and for your work. This was truly exceptional.
Thank you, Rachel. Talk to you soon.
If you want to learn more, I've put links to everything over on planetcritical.com, where you can subscribe to support this podcast and read the weekly newsletter inspired by each interview. If you liked this episode, leave a review and share it far and wide. If you loved it, choose a paid subscription at planetcritical.com to join the community. As always, my deepest thanks to that community. Planet Critical wouldn't exist without your support. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for coming on this journey together.